5 days, 4 minutes, well, 4 and a half today, I think, the week that was in the global economy. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Ryssdal. Friday, it is the 10th of June. Glad, as always, to have you with us, everybody. And yes, fine, politics has sucked most of the air out of the news this week. Most, but not all, which is why we're here. Hello. And by we, I mean Lee Gallagher from Fortune Magazine, also Sudeep Reddy from The Wall Street Journal. She is in New York. He is in Washington. Hey, everybody.
Hey, Kai. Okay.
Lee, let's start big picture, really big picture. There have been a couple of reports in the last week, certainly the World Bank this week, but also in the prior weeks, about slowing global economic growth. Why and how bad is it?
Well, it's projected to slow from 2.9% to 2.4%, according to the World Bank. That's not great. And it's a bunch of things. I mean, it's low commodities prices, a lot of debt in a lot of countries, slowing advanced countries, but also slowing emerging markets. So it's not great. I mean, you know, I'm usually pretty optimistic. And I, I do think, especially here, there's been a lot of talk about the last jobs report. I think that's, you know, you can't look at one report that way. I mean, globally, the situation is not great. On the other hand, you know, Europe is a lot better than it was a couple years ago. And there are other signs of, you know, reasons to be optimistic, not, you know, not the least of which is our stock market.
Yeah, well, so Sudeep, right? No, exactly. But Sudeep, we are strong. But if the rest of the world is not, it's going to bite us in the tuchus. Yeah,
it will eventually. The next global recession, whenever it comes, whether it's months or years or longer away, it will be the most anticipated and least surprising downturn of our lifetimes. There has been so little enthusiasm for this recovery we've been going through for the last 7 years. We are in the age of muddling through, and it's possible that we could just muddle through for a few more years longer through all of this, but it's going to be slow growth. There's nothing more than that.
That's like, so the global economy is meh from now till forever, and it's been meh. Is that what you're saying?
That's essentially where we are. There isn't a whole lot to look out for as big optimistic signs. There are a lot of risks on the horizon, but we've gotten through a lot of risks over the last 7 years, too.
All right. So, Lee, there's another risk. 13 days from now, June the 23rd, the British vote on the Brexit. You're just back from London. Give us the anecdotal what's going on over there story.
It's really interesting over there. I was struck that people seem to respond when you ask them about Brexit the way people in the U.S. respond when you ask them about Donald Trump.
Oh, man.
They sort of pause and they sigh and they don't know what to say. They don't know how it's come to this. And, you know, most people I spoke to don't want it to happen. There's a thought that this shouldn't be put to the people in terms that can be very easily spun to be so black and white.
Yeah.
Which, again, reminds us of what's happening here. But I think most people don't expect it to happen. But it's what everyone's talking about.
Sudeep, if it does happen, not a good thing for us.
Certainly not a good thing. You'll see a jolt in markets. You'll see uncertainty ripple throughout the rest of Europe, particularly places that are feeling the same kind of impulse. The real global risk here, I think, is much larger than the near-term consequences that we can see. It's just the shift toward isolationism with probably half of British voters, whether it's just below or above the line of 50, half of British voters may be thinking that they want to turn inward. Mm-hmm. And obviously, the UK is not alone. There are plenty of others in Europe who want to do that. There are plenty of people in the US who want to do that. And figuring out how to respond to a force like that after decades of trying to globalize the world and trying to connect all of us, that's a much, much harder problem to solve than what we usually deal with central banks and fiscal policy and everything like that.
Lee, let's combine topics number one and two. The global economy and Donald Trump, since you mentioned him, and let's combine it in the American election. We've been talking about the global economy muddling along, and we have an election now. So we're going to have five more months of our economy just keeping pace. Yeah,
I think we will. I think we're looking at that. I think a lot is going to be, you know, pending what happens in November. But I think that there, you know, earlier this week, I mean, markets did well. Some speculated it was because Trump stumbled a little bit. I think there is a little bit of fear, a lot of fear on behalf of investors of what could possibly happen if he takes office.
Sudeep, unknown unknowns, yeah? We don't know what it
unknown could, unknowns right. for 5 months. 5 months of trying to figure out what Donald Trump actually stands for and how far to the center Hillary Clinton will go if she does.
Sudeep Reddy at the Wall Street Journal. We got him down in Washington. Lee Gallagher was in our brand new spiffy bureau in New York City. Thanks, you two.
Thanks, Guy.
All right, we'll see you. Be good. On Wall Street today, well, it was a little grim. Actually, we'll have the details when we do the numbers. Corporate story of this Friday is a media story that wraps in Silicon Valley, celebrity journalism, the federal bankruptcy code, and the changing nature of web publishing. Maybe a little bit of huh, too. Gawker Media filed for Chapter 11 protection today after the judge in the Hulk Hogan sex tape suit confirmed a $140 million judgment against that company. Peter Kafka is a senior editor at Recode. He has been covering this case and the story. Peter, thanks for coming on.
Thanks for having me.
Give me your gut reaction to this news, huh?
This is something that Gawker's been trying to avoid for many months, and I think over the last few weeks sort of recognized was coming, but I think people outside the company, it'll be quite shocking to them.
The surprise really is how close Gawker was to the edge, right?
Yeah, I mean, Gawker didn't want to come out and say it for a bunch of reasons. They didn't want to upset their staff, but they, you know, at one point, maybe a year ago, they were out trying to raise money, and they were telling bankers they were going to be worth many hundreds of millions of dollars, and they were going to be very profitable. They ended up losing money last year, in part because they took on a big lease, but in large part because they were fighting this lawsuit against Hulk Hogan, it turns out, Peter Thiel.
Peter Thiel, the guy who, as you said, has been bankrolling this lawsuit, told the New York Times not too long ago, it's less about revenge and more about specific deterrence. How do you read that?
Well, it's very much about revenge. He's punishing Gawker for stories that it published about him and people who are his friends, in his own words. The deterrence thing is sort of interesting to think about. I mean, what are other publications supposed to think about now as they publish stories that might upset Peter Thiel or other billionaires? I don't know if Peter Thiel has really thought that one through, but it certainly is revenge against Gawker. I mean, the company's in Chapter 11. It's going to be sold. It's the definition of revenge.
So this is going to be a sale, right? It's Chapter 11 leading to a sale, and there's a bidder in the works already.
Yes, Ziff Davis has said they're going to buy the thing for something around $100 million. What Gawker is hoping is now that Ziff Davis has sort of staked a claim that it will get other bidders to come in and hopefully offer more money than that. I think Nick Denton would realistically like to get about twice that price.
Can we read into this anything about how fragile the web publishing business is?
I don't know that you can. I mean, I think Gawker, with or without the Hulk Hogan case, was probably already sort of going to be in the rearview mirror in web publishing. It had been eclipsed by bigger publishers like BuzzFeed, like Vox Media, where I work. It had sort of missed the Facebook era. It sort of belatedly had come to it. I think web publishing had sort of moved on from the era that where Gawker was a dominant publisher. This is a natural, normal thing. It's just how publishing works in general. There's plenty of good questions to ask about web publishing and digital publishing. I don't think the Gawker case is sort of indicative of most of them.
It's worth a mention that Ziff Davis, in their press release today, said, yeah, we're looking at Lifehacker and Gizmodo and a bunch of other properties that Gawker Media owns, but not Gawker itself.
Yeah, I think for quite some time, Dent and other folks have been trying to ring fence Gawker is the terminology they use. Where we have one bad asset, Gawker. It's tarnished. We realize no one wants to buy that. But these other assets, they have loyal traffic. They haven't done heinous things, or many of them haven't done heinous things. These have real value, and that's the proposition, and that seems to be the proposition that this is Ziff Davis thinks.
This will take a while because, as you write today, nobody wants to buy into a Peter Thiel lawsuit. So we're going to wait for that to get settled, and then this thing's going to proceed.
Yeah, I mean, the idea of Chapter 11, right, is sort of to get Gawker clear of that eventually. I don't really know how that will work because I'm not a bankruptcy expert, but that is the intent. There is no one who is buying a lawsuit from Peter Thiel.
Peter Kafka is a senior editor at Recode, talking to us about the Hulk Hogan case and Gawker. We got him on Skype. Peter, thanks a lot.
Thanks for having me.
C Season 5 of Showtime's House of Lies, Don Cheadle stars as a management consultant of questionable morality, wraps up this weekend with a first. The finale is the first American scripted television show shot in Cuba since diplomatic relations were restored. And it marks the beginning of what is sure to be a Hollywood rush. Fast and Furious 8 filmed there, so did Transformers The Last Knight. The House of Lies episode that airs this weekend is called No Es Fácil, It's Not Easy, which, as Marketplace's Adrian Hill reports, is a fitting description for filming in Cuba.
Early in the episode, management consultant and Uber capitalist Marty Kahn, played by Don Cheadle, salivates over the potential of the place.
Welcome to Cuba, the perfect jewel of newly budding capitalism. Like a long dormant socialist succulent, one that somebody forgot to water for 50 years.
That dormancy means landscapes are still lush, streets aren't cluttered with Starbucks, and of course, those classic cars.
There's almost nowhere you can point the camera that's not a beautiful image.
Matthew Carnahan is the creator of House of Lies. He also wrote and directed the final episode. He says he quickly learned some of the same lessons about doing business in Cuba that Marty Kahn learns.
Nothing here, right now, is easy. That doesn't mean that it's not worthwhile or good, just that it's not easy.
Carnahan talks me through what seems like a simple enough scene. Marty and Jeannie stumble upon a wedding in a small courtyard in Old Havana.
So you want to stay here at a wedding that we weren't invited to and hang out with a bunch of people that we don't know?
Yes! Yes!
Locations were very tricky because it's not like here where money talks and nothing else means really anything.
In Cuba, Carnahan says, one person issues all the location permits for the entire island. And then there's the music. Carnahan wanted this song, La Casa Chabaleta, played by this band, Septeto Habanero.
Which was an entire, you know, rigmarole because of how people get paid.
You can't just write a check in Cuba. The wedding scene also needed wedding guests, cast by one of the few casting directors on the island, who doesn't speak any English.
The casting director there is kind of this diva who just knows every single actor, knows exactly where they are on the island or not on the island, and whether they can, you know, get a ride.
No es fácil. Camera equipment was shipped from Germany because it couldn't be sent directly from the U.S. Even basic supplies.
There's not hammers and toilet paper and, you know, things that people need.
And catering? The wife and family of one of the local Cuban producers did all the cooking for the crew, which included about 60 members hired locally.
There is definitely a film community and amazing filmmakers and craftspeople, but they're not in the business of making movies yet.
But Hollywood keeps coming. Carnahan says on one hand, he wants everyone to shoot everything there. And on the other,
I want to be greedy and, you know, never let anyone else go there because it's so remarkable. It's so special and it's in a particular moment between the old and the new.
A moment that's quickly passing. I'm Adrian Hill for Marketplace.
Coming up,
listeners to the show might not guess that that includes financial aid for going to college.
But what is that? Oh, you got to stick around, because first, we're going to do the numbers. Worries ruled the day on Wall Street. Today, the Dow Industrials gave back 119 points, 2/3%, 17,865. The Nasdaq sliced off 64 points, about 1.25%, 48.94. The S&P 500 unloaded 19 points, about 0.9%, 2,096. Therefore, the week gone by, the Dow up 0.3%, the Nasdaq down 1%, the S&P 500 forfeited a 0.1%. Financials got hit hard today. Bank of America down nearly 2.5%. Citigroup withdrew 2.4%. Goldman Sachs off 2%. Reports that Amazon is going to launch a standalone music streaming service couldn't revive the internet giant's shares, down 1.33%. Today, Pandora in worse shape. a 3% loss. Apple, which is still trying to build its music streaming service, bit off 0.8%. Anybody for fixing iTunes over there? Tim Cook? Anybody? Anybody? Bonds rose. The yield on the 10-year T-note fell to 1.64%. Boy, won't I be surprised if I get a response. You're listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. A lot can happen in life in 20 years. And that's just talking about one person or maybe one family's circumstances. Forget about an entire slice of public policy in this country's economy. Welfare reform is 20 years old this year, ending, if you remember the catchphrase at the time, welfare as we know it. In its place came a program that emphasized work and had time limits on how long you could be on welfare. It became known as TANF, Temporary Assistance to Needy Families, and it was paid for by federal block grants to the states. It's also 20 years of welfare reform, that is. It's also the subject of our newest podcast. It's from our Wealth and Poverty Desk, and it's called The Uncertain Hour. Marketplace's Chrissy Clark hosts it, and she has been on something of a cross-country trip looking at how states spend those welfare dollars 20 years on. Michigan is today's stop.
Explain, for somebody who can't see what's going on right now, what the hell is going on right now?
Okay, so I guess you call it a rave dance. There's people out here dancing and having fun with some glow lights right in front of them.
I'm in a dark gymnasium on the campus of Adrian College, an expensive private college in southeastern Michigan. It's crazy in here. There are students engulfed in giant plastic bubbles playing soccer, students squirting glow-in-the-dark paint at each other.
And then Hunger Games archery with toy arrows.
Now, it just so happens, except hold that thought, I'm going to break the fourth wall and turn down the rave music a little because it's hurting my brain. Much better. Now, it just so happens that many of the people at this college-sponsored rave party are 20 years old, meaning they were born the same year that welfare reform was born. So in between glow paint wars and bubble soccer and Taylor Swift songs, I was curious to know from these guys, what comes to mind when you hear the word welfare? What do you know about welfare?
Welfare?
I think of like a welfare check.
It's good for some people, but there's times where welfare is bad because it's just turning around into drug money or right to the liquor store.
But here's the thing. All those students who just answered my question, they didn't know it until I told them, but actually, they are on welfare too. Once upon a time, welfare was basically a program where the federal government sent monthly welfare checks to families based on economic need. But with welfare reform and the new block grant system,
what Bill Clinton and Congress did was told the states, you get a certain amount of money and you set up your own programs.
Here's senior analyst Peter Ruark with the Michigan League for Public Policy.
And you can spend this money as long as it fits under four purposes.
Purpose one,
to provide assistance to needy families.
Basically what we think of as welfare. Purpose two,
to end the dependence of needy parents on government benefits by promoting job preparation and work.
Purpose three,
to prevent and reduce out-of-wedlock pregnancies.
And purpose four,
to encourage the formation of two-parent families.
And those four purposes, written into the 1996 welfare reform law, have been interpreted in some interesting ways. So much so that today, only a fraction of the money, just about a quarter nationwide, actually goes to cash assistance for poor families anymore. And the rest goes to
everything but the kitchen sink. I mean, it's a big slush fund.
Some of that money shows up at private colleges in Michigan, like Adrian College, where that glow-in-the-dark party happened. Of the 1,700 students who go there, who mostly grew up in middle-class or upper-middle-class families, more than half receive money from the Temporary Assistance for Needy Families Block Grant. That is federal welfare money to help cover their nearly $45,000 a year tuition. Kelly Zekin is a junior at Adrian.
I am an accounting major.
And one of these unwitting welfare recipients. The money she gets comes through a program called the Michigan Tuition Grant. It's specifically targeted to Michigan students who go to private colleges in-state, takes into account how much their families make compared to how expensive a school is, Kelly gets about $1,800 a year from the tuition grant, which she's grateful for.
Free money, I guess, is kind of the running joke in our house. But, you know, I didn't know exactly what qualified me for it. I hadn't really looked much into it.
I did look deeper into the Michigan tuition grant, and here's how it works. Remember those four purposes that I mentioned earlier that restrict what states can spend their welfare block grants on?
Well, I found a pie chart, and it's quite interesting.
That's policy analyst Peter Ruark again, the kind of guy who appreciates a good pie chart. But this is the kind of pie chart that actually any taxpayer should find quite interesting, since it's all about how federal tax dollars, dollars that go towards one of the most controversial programs around, welfare, are spent.
What we see is only 12% of that federal funding in Michigan goes toward welfare payments.
That is, basic cash assistance to poor families. Meanwhile, in Michigan, almost three times as much, 33%, goes toward
out-of-wedlock pregnancy prevention,
which is one of the four purposes that states can spend welfare dollars on.
But this out-of-wedlock pregnancy prevention, listeners to the show might not guess that that includes financial aid for going to college.
Wait, what? that's a convoluted set of dots.
Yes.
But connected those dots are. As of this year, Michigan puts almost $100 million of its more than $700 million TANF block grant towards in-state college-granted scholarship programs, all in the name of preventing out-of-wedlock pregnancy. And there's another reason this welfare spending on college financial aid is worth examining.
Some of this financial aid does not go toward low-income families. There's actually quite a bit of it that goes to upper-middle-class families.
In fact, according to the most available data, about 6% of the Michigan tuition grant, which is funded by $34 million of federal welfare money, 6% of that goes to students whose families earn more than $100,000 a year.
Hi, Debbie.
Yeah.
Nice to meet you. I'm Chrissy.
Hi, nice to meet you.
Hi, thanks.
Debbie Petersmark lives in East Lansing, Michigan, on a tree-lined suburban street where she and her ex-husband, Mike, raised their three kids. Their oldest, Andy, just finished his sophomore year at Adrian College, and he receives a Michigan tuition grant funded by Temporary Assistance for Needy Families. The Petersmarks do not fit the typical definition of a needy family. Mike's a CPA. Debbie sells ads for a local TV station. Together, they fall into the upper end of earners in America, more than $200,000 a year. But even when you make that much money, college can be expensive, especially a private college like Adrian.
You're basically, with college, you're basically buying a brand new car every year that you have to pay in full for it right then.
And when I tell Mike and Debbie that some of the financial aid their son gets is welfare money,
I personally think it's terrific because just because a kid grows up in a home that might have a little bit more money than the next doesn't mean that they're not entitled to some help from the government for college. I mean, it doesn't matter how much money you make. You're still forking over $30,000 a year for college is a hardship.
You can hear the rest of the story and how Michigan explains the link between college scholarships and out-of-wedlock pregnancy prevention on our podcast, The Uncertain Hour. I'm Chrissy Clark for Marketplace.
I ought to mention here, you can subscribe to The Uncertain Hour wherever you get your podcasts. And also, you can see how your state spends its welfare dollars at our website, marketplace.org. This final note on the way out, Warcraft the movie opens in this country today based on the online game called World of Warcraft. It's already made $100 million and counting in China, but its box office prospects here are, we should just say they're unclear at best. I called up Scott Johnson. He's been hosting a podcast about World of Warcraft called The Instance for about the last 10 years. He is going to see this movie, of course, this weekend, along with a small army of friends flying in from out of town.
Yeah, it'll be if you can call 335 people an army, but yes, well, we're gonna fill that out.
it's a small but powerful army. How did this come to pass? I mean, you're a guy with a podcast, and this is a big video game, but this seems to be sort of extraordinary.
Well, it goes a little bit beyond it just being a game, or even it just being a movie. Much to the contrast of a lot of stereotypes out there, it is a game that actually encourages a lot of meetups and friendships, and people get married in this game. And I think this movie represents another chance for us to all get together, hang out, talk about our stories, and just have a good time.
Take a second and listen to my whole interview with Scott Johnson. We talked about a bunch of stuff. Actually, it is at marketplace.org. Friday, quitting time. Got to go. The Dow gave back 119 points today, 0.2%. The NASDAQ off 64 points, 1.25% there. The S&P 500 down 19, about 0.9%. Our theme music was composed by BJ Lederman. Marketplace is produced by Nancy Fargali. Sitar Nieves is the executive producer. Deborah Clark is the vice president around here. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We'll see you again on Monday, everybody. Have a good weekend. This is APM. Hey, everybody, it's Kai. We wanted to introduce you to a new podcast from Marketplace brought to you by the Wealth and Poverty Desk. It's called The Uncertain Hour. You can think of it as a docupod. It dives deep into the uncertainties of our economy in ways you don't often hear. We know, you're going to enjoy it. Also, it's not actually an hour, more like, standard podcast length, 20, 30 minutes.